Welcome to Double Take with Matt and Jake. This is Jake, joined by Matt, as always. Today is Wednesday, April 19th. A lot going on. We're about 1 week away from the NFL draft. Middle of the first round of the NBA playoffs. The Boston Marathon happened on Monday. We're going to talk about all those things, mostly in the opposite order, where we're going to focus on the NFL draft stuff. Do some basketball, very little bit of the Boston Marathon. Matt wanted to get that in, so we will talk about that for sure. And a couple other miscellaneous things before we get into the big topics. For Matt, the Boston Marathon is like a holiday, though, so we do have to discuss that. And I'll just let you kind of take the reins for that.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna make us take a whole lot of time, but a couple people that we needed to shout out, namely Eliud Kipchoge finishing in sixth place, big upset. Kipchoge is a world record holder. He has won four of the World Marathon Majors, obviously biggest accomplishment, two Olympic gold medals. Seems to have had an upper leg injury, but this is concerning because he was the overwhelming favorite. Not only for this race, but also for the Olympics next year. And so now, Kenya has a really hard choice to make because they've got, I think you have to put Evans Chebet on the team, who has won Boston 2 years in a row, also has won, I believe, New York. It could be a different marathon. He's going to have to be on the team. They've got a really good 23-year-old that ran 202 or 201, which is just right behind Kipchoge's world record. And so he's going to really be fighting for a spot on that Kenyan team. And so it's just interesting. We have drama in the marathon world.
We do have drama.
And then shout out to Connor Mance finishing 11th out of BYU. And then Helen O'Beery won the women's race. Top American was Emma Bates, who had a really, really great run, finishing fifth, but quite a close fifth. You know, not too far behind the leaders at all. So you just think she's eventually going to break through and get one of these major marathon wins at some point. So that's all I wanted to say, really.
Very interesting. Now, you also had some stuff about the NSWL Women's Soccer League, some news there.
Yes, National Women's Soccer League for the Utah Royals. Very exciting, those of us who are in Utah. There have been reports that the first coach of the Utah Royals will be none other than Amy Rodriguez.
My girl.
Which I'm absolutely delighted about. She was on the Utah Royals all the years they existed, was a mainstay with the U.S. Women's National Team, and then I've got her jersey, so I can wear that to Royals games, and I'll have the coach's jersey on. So it'll be like when people would wear Jason Kreis's jersey to Real games before he left, you know? So it's going to be cool, and she's, you know, really, really smart. She was the captain when she was here, beloved by her teammates. And so, yeah, I think, you know, it's never a sure thing when players come in to be coaches, but I think she's got the tools to do a really great job, so I'm excited.
Awesome. When does that season start?
NWSL, if it hasn't... NWSL has started. The Royals are not going to be joining the league until 2024. We can do a quick check-in. The Thorns and the Spirit are at the top. There's only been three matches so far, and there's only one division, so there's no division leaders we need to check in. But the Thorns and Washington Spirit are up top, much as expected, followed by San Diego Wave and OL Reign in Seattle. So very consistently good teams. Kansas City, who went to the finals last year, has lost their first three games. So that's the really big surprise.
Now, in the MLS and men's soccer, Real Salt Lake's like the worst team in the league. So I have lost a little bit of interest in that, I will say.
Yeah, and I think me and you are similar. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like we are willing to watch. I was thinking about this today, actually, with the Real. I think we're both willing to watch a bad team as long as we know it's going in the right direction. You know, like, the reason I enjoy being a Jazz fan, despite never having won a title, is there's always a plan. I always feel like we're making smart moves and doing the best we can. I do not feel that way about Real Salt Lake. Obviously, the Deloy Hansen era was just a dumpster fire. Things have gotten better, but we're just ultimately not spending enough money to be successful.
No. So that's kind of a bummer, but soccer is a fantastic sport here. And excited for both those Utah teams to do better. And I'll start getting into it a little bit more, especially once the NFL draft is over.
Speaking of dumpster fires, Todd Boehly's really running Chelsea into the ground.
Yeah, man. I think it sounds like, you know, you spent all that money in the transfer window. It seems like you're just spending money just to spend money. And you, by you, I don't mean you personally, obviously, yeah. But it doesn't seem like there's a lot of research and development going on.
Yeah, we just didn't get anybody that we can use.
Just a lot of expensive players for the sake of it.
Yeah, so that's been disappointing. And then, so we're just going to have to redo the whole team, get in a whole new coach. So it's going to be a multi-year project to fix this mess, which is pretty upsetting. So,
you know, it is what it is. Should we talk a little bit NBA playoffs before we dive into the mock draft stuff?
Yeah, we can talk about the playoffs a little bit.
So I think the only thing that's been kind of... I was surprised the Clippers won Game 1 and surprised Miami won Game 1. I don't... And surprised the Knicks won Game 1 also. Like, all three of those series I thought would be relatively easy for those teams. I don't think there'll be a problem. No, I don't see any of my series predictions being an issue. Maybe like the actual games, but I don't think anything that happened the first weekend is gonna throw off our predictions that we had. Which for the first round, we were basically on the same page for everything.
Yeah, I mean the Warriors are down 2-0. Obviously, they're going back to Golden State.
Oh, but you're right. That's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Warriors should be concerned for sure. But hey, I mean. Teams coming back from down 2-0 is not the most uncommon thing in the world. We've seen it done before, and if anybody can do it, we've seen the Warriors come back from down 2-1. I believe we've seen the Warriors come back from 3-1 against the Rockets once or twice. I mean, the Warriors can do it. It's just they haven't really looked like the Warriors all year. Now they still don't look like the Warriors. So it is concerning that they haven't seemed to turn it on.
At what point would you be concerned? Are you concerned now, or would you have to lose game three or like go 1-1 at home if you're the Warriors? Because Draymond's suspended for this.
Concerned about losing the series?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned right now. Obviously, you have to win game three. You can't go down 3-0, right? So you absolutely have to win. I think alarm bells should already be going off, but maybe like a code 4 out of 5, and then you go down 3-1. It's 5 out of 5, because then you have to win the rest of the games.
Yeah.
It becomes a must-win situation.
All of us, I guess all of us being me and you, but I think most people are picking the Warriors just because we'd rather be too late to jump off something than too early. Bill Belichick was early to jump off Tom Brady, and he ended up winning Super Bowl. But, I mean, at this point he's retired, and Bill Belichick was like, I'd rather him, you know, be successful somewhere else than have him, you know, farting around here. I think we have that tendency with...
Yeah, because you remember better than me. I don't remember too much of NFL in the past. Like, I don't feel like the Patriots were winning the Super Bowl with Tom Brady, though.
No. Well, the Patriots were just a bad team.
Yeah.
Like, Tom Brady, I don't think it had gotten worse, but, like, he didn't have anyone to throw to. The supporting cast just wasn't great, and the part, as great as Brady is, he was taking those pay cuts, and the teams were fantastic, really well built around him. And the Patriots had just evolved where they did need a reset. So it was time to let Tom go just because he wasn't going to be able to win another one in New England. And obviously he did in Tampa. which good for him. But I think with the Warriors, we have that tendency where, like, they're the Warriors. Or, like, the Lakers, I even picked them to do decently well just because they have LeBron James, and I don't want to bet against them. I'd rather be wrong betting on LeBron than wrong betting against LeBron.
Right.
You know? Made that mistake a couple times. So are we saying the Kings are the only team? What's your confidence meter in the Kings winning the series, 1 to 10? 10 is they already have it locked up. 1 is you don't think they have a shot, even being up 2-0.
I'm going to say 7. I think 8 is too high just because Steph Curry is on the Warriors, right?
Yeah.
And I think 6 would be to totally ignore anything else that's happened. So I'm going to say 7 out of 10.
I was going to say between 6 or 7 as well. I kind of want to say 6 just because of Steph, but I think, you know, 2-0 lead is pretty big.
That's a lot, yeah.
Let's just go through the series and kind of look at that. So Nuggets are up 1-0. As we speak, they're beating Minnesota. I think we both think they'll be up 2-0. Confidence scale in the Nuggets, 1 to 10.
9.
Really? I was going to say 10. You have 9?
Yeah, I mean, like, the Timberwolves are still an NBA team, you know? Like, it's not... Yeah, I mean, obviously they're winning by 10 now, so...
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll say 9. Like, I do, you know, despite past results, I think Rudy's a good playoff player. I don't know how much I trust anybody else on the team.
Now, Suns-Clippers, I think that's going to be the best series. Kawhi Leonard, I almost said Leonard with a W. He was the best player on the floor in Game 1 and probably Game 2 and even the loss. I think he ended up with 31.
Yeah.
In that game. So if the Clippers are getting that Kawhi, I think neither of us were anticipating that when we picked the Suns. Right now, series is tied 1-1. They play a Game 3 again tomorrow. Let's say the Suns 1-10. Where are you at?
I think 6. You know, I think 7 is too sure for me. Like, you know, 70% is a good passing grade, you know, being a teacher. So I'm gonna say 6. I just think, despite the fact that I don't think they've played enough together to actually be successful, I don't think the Clippers have enough talent to really challenge them.
Yeah, now if Kawhi goes off, though, that's the only reason it's not for me at, like, even losing Game 1 not at a 9 or a 10 is because of Kawhi.
But I just also think there's going to be a game where Kawhi goes off, but so does Kevin Durant, and then the Suns win.
That's why I want to say 7, just because, I do like Norman Powell a lot. He's one of my favorite, I think, best role players in the league because I think he's over 40% three-point shooter, but he also attacks the basket as well as anyone. I think he's a good distributor. So as a role player, you know, I like him, and I think he's played a big part, will play a big part. But it's just tough to circle away from Kevin Durant as well, Chris Paul being the third guy at this point, DeAndre Ayton being the fourth guy, who I've never been a huge DeAndre Ayton guy. But I would put the Suns at a 7 on that.
Yeah.
Warriors, we already talked about. I'm going to say 6 for the Kings. I know you're a little higher than that. Okay, what about this one? Grizzlies-Lakers. Grizzlies just tied it up 1-1. Let's say for the Grizzlies, since they're the higher seed, what's your confidence meter on them winning the series?
I'm really at like a 5 at a 50-50. Okay. You know, it's 1-1. The Lakers got one of the games in Memphis. The Lakers have LeBron James. I think the Grizzlies are a better team. But, yeah, I don't know. I truly think this could go either way. I might... Yeah, technically, the way it breaks down, if we assume that I can't give... that a 0 is not on the scale, a 5 technically favors the Lakers, and that's where I want to be.
Okay. So you're on the Lakers side.
Barely.
Okay.
Barely.
A titch on the Lakers side.
Yeah.
I would say for the Grizzlies, that was a very mathematical answer more than I was thinking about. I would say for the Grizzlies, a 3.
Really?
Yeah. It was honestly like a 1.5 after game one, but, you know, coming back, winning game two, relatively confidently, I would say, as well. I think if they can, I still think the Lakers are going to win. I expect them to win both those games at home, but if the Grizzlies can win one, then it's 2 out of 3 and anything can happen. And I wouldn't be surprised if it goes to 6 or 7 and or goes to 7, but I just have too much confidence in LeBron as much as anything else, like we already talked about.
Yeah.
One thing, back to the Timberwolves real quick before we go to the Eastern Conference. We haven't really talked about Ant-Man that much, and I mean everyone. I haven't really heard, last year he was the star of the first round of the playoffs. And now it's the Gobert thing, and maybe it's because they're playing Denver. But Ant-Man's kind of been a forgotten person. You know?
Yeah, I mean, has he done very much?
No, but I don't... I mean, I felt like last year he wasn't doing a ton other than putting up highlights. Like, I know he was scoring a lot, but I don't know. Just interesting. Like, I honestly forgot he was on the team until Mike Conley was just talking to him.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's just... I'm not going to get excited about the Timberwolves.
Yeah. No. All right, let's go to the Eastern Conference. So, right now, Bucks are down 1-0, but they're killing the Heat by 30-ish. And the fourth quarter hasn't even started yet. So let's assume that's a 1-1 game. Confidence on the Bucks winning the series?
10. I'm 10, more
confident. That's more than the Nuggets.
Yeah, that is more than the Nuggets. I think they're a much better team. There's just no way Giannis is losing in the first round.
See, I'd say 8 just because I think Jimmy Butler's will is worth 2 points on the confidence meter, if nothing else.
Yeah, but Jimmy Butler and what army, though, you know?
Duncan Robinson. The Strauss kid?
Yeah,
Tyler Hero. I'm not saying I'm very confident. That's my second highest confidence I've given out. But I think they have a fighting chance. They won game one. You know, let's say they split the Miami games 1-1. So they go back to Milwaukee, tied 2-2. They just need a home split, and it's an interesting series.
Yeah. I don't think Giannis is going to let that happen. But
I don't either, but I'm just saying 8. Like, an 8 is very confident. It's just not a 10.
All right.
Cavaliers-Knicks. Knicks won game one, which I was a little surprised about. I thought this would be a 5-game series. Looks like it'll probably go a little longer than that. What's your confidence in Cleveland?
I'm going to say 8 in Cleveland. I'm still pretty confident. I think they're a much better team. They have, as good as Jalen Brunson is, I think Donovan Mitchell is much better, and he's got much better supporting players around him. So the Knicks are a good team. They've got a lot of really good pieces. I just don't think that Jalen Brunson can be your best player. He might be able to be your second best player, but I don't think he can be your best player.
I'm going to say 8 as well, which makes me want to change my Milwaukee answer to 9, putting it in that context. So yeah. I'll say 8 for the Cavaliers as well. Philadelphia-Brooklyn, one of the best series from a drama standpoint. Philly's up 2-0, going to Brooklyn. What's your confidence meter in Philly?
10.
Yeah, I'm a 10. I don't think it gets back to Philly.
No, I don't. And I actually feel like if I was going to put the Bucks a little bit higher of a 10 than I would for the Sixers. But yeah, I just don't. As fun of a story as the Nets have been, after getting rid of Kyrie and Kevin Durant, they're not going to be able to do it.
Well, I mean, let's just do that because the Celtics, I think, are both going to say 10 as well. So let's rank it. Bucks, Celtics, Sixers, in that tier, I think we both put a 10 there. Who do you feel the most confident in after the first couple games?
As far as winning the whole thing?
Yeah, sure. Just to make it exciting, because I think we're both going to say 10 for the Celtics as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, Boston looks really good. I'm going to say Boston first.
Because I'd put Milwaukee and Boston as 1B, like right behind them, and then Philly in that next tier.
Yeah.
As, like, still by far, you know, contender. But I'd put Boston and Milwaukee in one tier together, with Milwaukee slightly ahead.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's going to be the Bucks and the Celtics are going to play at some point, and the winner of them is going to go to the NBA Finals.
Okay, so we both think the Celtics, because I was just about to say, I think the Celtics-Sixers is going to be an awesome series. Sounds like you're not super confident in the Sixers in that.
No, and the Sixers are really good. They might be the third best team in the NBA, but I just think the Celtics are that much better.
Right. Should we talk some NFL draft?
Yeah.
So this is what we're going to talk about and how we did it. So I did a mock draft a little bit differently. Basically, I mean, it's a mock draft. There's only so much variation you can get. But A, I did it. Me not predicting, but what I would do as a GM of each NFL team. I also, instead of just doing the first round, because there's some teams that didn't have a first round pick, so I did every team's first pick. So like for San Francisco, that was 99. For Denver, that was like 68 or something like that. 67.
That is bad news for the Broncos.
Oh, yeah.
That is bad news.
They're not in good shape.
Yeah.
And I also did like their whole draft strategy. Now, I am a believer in drafting receivers and corners and defensive linemen. So realistically, that is what I said for a lot of teams. But there are teams where I was like, they need to get a backup running back. They need to attack tackle specifically. Draft a backup quarterback, for example. So I did the first pick for each team, what it should be. And every pick in the first round. So like Houston, Philadelphia, Seattle. I did every like both those players in the first round they should draft. And then the strategy for it.
Yeah.
Now, what did you think of it? We'll go through and go talk about some teams specifically, but what were your thoughts kind of reading through it?
Well, first thing I want to comment on, we don't have to talk about this. Broncos 67, Marvin Mims, early front runner for best name of the draft. I love that. It sounds like Martian Manhunter, but Marvin the Martian is the Looney Tune.
Yeah.
Marvin Mims is a cousin of those dudes. And I love the name. That's all I have to say about
probably
that.
Probably get some merch, some Marvin merch.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But yeah, no, I liked this setup. I liked seeing, you know, if a team's got two first round picks, just seeing them listed together, I think made it easier to read. And I also thought the strategy was really interesting as someone who's not really a draft expert to look at in which rounds these teams are going to be able to address these needs, and also kind of how this strategy stretches into multiple years and it's not really just a this year thing. I mean, that's obviously something I knew, but it's interesting to see how a little bit more concretely how teams might be thinking about these things.
Yeah, well, it's nearly 7,000 words, so every team got a good dosage. But what you're talking about, like the Eagles, for example, most people have them pegged at offensive line or defensive line. And the reason for offensive line is Lane Johnson's probably going to be retiring next year. Jason Kelsey's probably going to be retiring next year. But I'm going corner in the first round because Darius Slay and James Bradbury, I think, are 35 and 34 respectively. Both on two-year deals, so you're going to need some replacing there as well. And realistically, rookies don't contribute their rookie year, so the smart thing is to be drafting and being able to draft 2 years ahead. And if you're doing roster construction the right way, you can do that instead of chasing for a rookie you need to contribute right away, because that's not going to be realistic most times.
Yeah, no, I'd be thrilled with a corner. I've wanted the Eagles to pick a corner in the first round for about 7 years in a row. I saw somebody saying that they thought the Eagles might draft the Texas running back at 10, and I just almost kicked my desk.
I didn't even mention Bijan in here.
Yeah. So I'm sure you're a great player, Bijan. I just think that we're pretty set at running back. So yeah, I would love a cornerback. And I think it is, you know, it because yeah, this. The Eagles are a team that's like, if we're not careful, this whole thing could fall apart in 2 years. So
seen it happen a lot. Yeah. Are there any teams you want to go through specifically? There's a couple of players I want to talk about, but are there any teams besides the Eagles you want to look at or talk through?
Yeah, I thought...
you're only on the Ravens, I think. You haven't made it all the way through.
No, I did get one a little bit further while you were setting up, so I did get through the Vikings. I thought the Packers were interesting. You've got them picking Kincaid, a great player. I really like tight ends. I think just being a BYU fan, We've had so many great tight ends through the years, and that's, I think that's a problem right now. Is like, I don't remember the last really, really good BYU tight end, not in the Kalani Sitake era, really. So I think it's an interesting pick for the Packers, and they're obviously in an interesting situation in that they've got a, you know, losing Aaron Rodgers. They're in a really weird bad now. We got to see how we can, you know, get good as quick as possible.
Yeah, and Jordan, like, the benefit, we've talked about this, benefit of a rookie quarterback is having his rookie contract, and by year three, he should be contending for a Super Bowl. They're not going to be able to do that with Jordan Love, but we do need to explore, is he worth the fifth-year option or not, we being the Packers in this scenario. Jordan Addison and Jaxon Smith-Njigba were both off the board by this point. I don't even remember where Jaxon Smith-Njigba ended up going, but as far as Kincaid, he was the best Also, Michael Mayer went earlier, so he was by far the best pass catcher available at this point. Tight end's an easy way. Kincaid's a natural route runner, creates separation. It's an easy way to just help Jordan Love's development. If a receiver is there, I think that makes sense. And think of the irony. Aaron Rodgers, the whole time he's in Green Bay, all he wants is a first-round pass catcher. The first year he leaves, if they drafted one, how funny that would be.
That would be funny.
That'd be hilarious.
So for comedic value, I would love that to happen.
Technically not gone yet, but that is kind of what we're cheering for.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they need to... They have needs. They're probably going to draft a defensive lineman, realistically. I think they should go for a Kincaid or a pass catcher there. Also shore up the interior offensive line. And focus. Your goal is not to win a Super Bowl, because that's not going to happen. Your goal is to see if Jordan Love can be the guy, mm-hmm. or if you need to go back to the quarterback. Well, that should be Green Bay's only focus.
For sure. One of the other ones I was interested in was the Vikings taking Hendon Hooker, quarterback out of Tennessee. They obviously need to figure out quarterback soon with Kirk Cousins being 35. That's crazy that Kirk Cousins is 35, by the way.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, but it's just kind of the debate, like, is the college quarterback, meaning playing a college system, is that going to work in the NFL?
Yeah, it's tough because the volunteer, and we just haven't seen a quarterback from that, like, Art Briles Baylor system where the receivers, if you watch a Tennessee game, the receivers are out past the numbers most of the time. We haven't seen a quarterback do well coming out of that. Now, I do think Hendon Hooker is the best quarterback who's played in that system, and at the end of the day, he did it really well. So I don't think it's fair to judge him just because of that system, but it does bring up legit questions of can he be in an NFL offense. Now, when he was at Virginia Tech, he didn't play in that Art Briles system, and I thought he was a good, not great player, but I did think he was a plus college quarterback. Coming to Tennessee, he has great anticipation, understanding the offense. He didn't ask to be in that offense. You know, he was playing what, doing what the coaches told him. I thought he did it really well. We talked a few episodes ago, watching the Tennessee-Florida game, watching the Tennessee-Kentucky game, watching Hendon Hooker go against Anthony Richardson and Will Levis. And Will Levis wasn't an NFL system. Hendon Hooker was just a better player. Now, there's a lot that goes into it besides just how good you are on the field in college. So I'm not saying Hendon Hooker should go ahead of those guys. Also, Hendon Hooker's age is a concern. He's 25. Coming off the ACL tear, but that's why I think Minnesota is a perfect spot for him. You have a year to learn how to be an NFL quarterback in an NFL offense, recover from your knee injury. If they draft him there, Kirk Cousins is the guy. He's not going to be expected to play. It fits perfectly, though, with Kirk Cousins' contract. He's free agent after the season. Hendon Hooker can step in year two. Year development, year of coaching, and he just needs it to, you know, take under center, snaps under center, identify the mic. Patrick, I don't think this is Hooker's problem, but Patrick Mahomes has said he didn't even know how to identify the mic coming out of Texas Tech to the Kansas City Chiefs. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying Hooker doesn't know how to do that, but just an example of that sitting does help. And not everyone needs to do it, but sitting, especially in court offenses that don't translate to the NFL. So I just think Hooker's too good of a fit. Minnesota's too desperate for a quarterback, where this is kind of the 2024 move, but I think it makes too much sense for Minnesota not to take. And that's actually more than any pick and player what I want to see happen.
Yeah. Cool. Last thing I want to do, you can obviously bring up anything that you would like to. But I always enjoy comparing the wide receivers. I think we're at a point where we watch the wide receivers 40 and their broad jump probably more than any other position. Those are kind of the fun combine events.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and just seeing like the way that it works out, I mean, the most famous example in my recent memory is Jalen Reagor and then Justin Jefferson getting picked the pick immediately after, very close, right? What are you looking at with the receivers and who's maybe someone you worry about that is going high and then maybe someone you think is going to go lower that you like?
I'd say worry about, I'm not a big fan of Quentin Johnson from TCU. You know, you watch him and the benefits are he's a freak athlete, contested catches, high points the ball, and he doesn't really do that. Like, if you watch him at TCU, a lot of his highlights, he's wide open, which is great. So that's really the best skill you can have as a receiver.
Uh-huh.
But he had a really low contested catch rate and a really high drop rate. And I think I actually mentioned those specifically and wherever I had him going, which where I can't remember. But that's my issue with Quentin Johnson. You can't get yards after the catch if you don't catch the ball. He has a lot of catches where he's catching it with his shoulder pads instead of his hands, which, you know, that really bugs me.
Right.
When receivers do that. Just use your hands, not your chest. So that's what worries about me. At the combine, he jumped, but that was all he did. He had a 40.5-inch vert, 11.2 broad jump, which is fantastic, super explosive. Didn't do any 40, any change of direction stuff, so that's what worries me about him. When Kelvin Benjamin came out of Florida State, he did test and had horrible change of direction times, and he wasn't. For a receiver, I think that's as more important than the 40 is the change of direction, the short shuttle, three cone, things like that. An example of that is Cooper Kupp ran a 4.6 40.
Yeah.
Justin Jefferson didn't run a great 40. I don't remember what it was, but I think it was like mid 4.5s. It's just like fine.
Yeah. How often do you think that NFL players actually run a 40 during a game?
Not very often, because, and I've talked about this when looking at deep routes, you're not just running straight. There's a lot of nuance that goes into that, where it's not just a straight sprint. So you're more running it when you already have the ball in your hands, not when you're getting open. Teams are using GPS data more and more than the actual 40 time. 40, and I think, is more important for cornerbacks than receiver. Jaxon Smith-Njigba from Ohio State, he ran a 40 as like 4.5 something.
Uh-huh.
Just fine. But he had unbelievable change of direction drill times. And for that reason, this is, everyone has him as wide receiver one for the most part. I think he can legitimately, not saying he will, but I think his ceiling is best receiver in the NFL. I'm not in on Jaxon Smith-Njigba. Just because when he was at Ohio State, he was there with Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave. And both of them, without hesitation, like, he's the best one out of us three.
Uh-huh.
Like, to be fair, in the Rose Bowl game, the last, like, real college game he played, he was being guarded by a running back. But he had, like, what, 300 receiving yards in that game?
It was something.
Do you remember how good he was?
It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy.
He's unbelievable. I legit think, and everyone's pegging him as a slot. When Justin Jefferson was coming out, everyone's like, oh, he's a slot guy. Just because that's what Jefferson did at LSU, and that's what Smith-Njigba did at Ohio State. I think the absolute worst, like, worst-case scenario for Jaxon Smith-Njigba is Julian Edelman, which is a very good, productive receiver.
Yeah.
Best guy, I legit think he could be a top-five receiver in the league, like, no questions at all. So that's who I'm high on. Now, someone who's not the obvious first-round receiver who I like, I would say Marvin Mims, the guy we had going.
Mims.
Your guy.
Yeah.
Guy we had going to the Denver Broncos. Questions about him, he's under 6 foot, which you never love to see. But he was a stud in high school, which is where I kind of started following him and watching his game. I think he's a really good route runner, and we talked about that deep threat. And in the Mims section in the Denver Broncos, I linked an article that I wrote when I was writing for North Carolina about kind of the nuances of getting open, running deep, and how to create separation and body movement. And he does all those things really well. So, A, I think he'd be a great fit in Denver. But even just in general, I think he's going to be a really good, really productive receiver. So, Quinn Johnson, to answer your question, someone I'm not high on and worried about, where that is going, you know, typically in the first round.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin Mims is someone I would really, really want to draft who's going outside of that.
All right. Well, we're getting close.
Yeah, 1 week away.
We're getting very close.
Super, super excited. Oh, yeah, I found my Quinn Johnson thing. Yeah. So, contested catch opportunities, Quinn Johnson was under 50%. He also had a higher than 10% drop rate, according to PFF, which... not great.
Not ideal.
Especially when your thing is big contested catch receiver. A couple things I want to talk about quickly, and then we can wrap up here. First one, I have Michael Mayer, Notre Dame tight end, going 7 to the Las Vegas Raiders. I'm higher on Michael Mayer than anyone else's as well. And everyone's fallen in love with Kincaid. We watch Kincaid a lot being, you know, in Utah. We just watched a lot of Utah football games. But Michael Mayer, man, he does everything well. He doesn't create as much separation as Kincaid, not as explosive as Kincaid, but he also doesn't need to. He's such a good route runner, really good body control. And because of his blocking ability, he is going to be a day one starter in the NFL. Fantasy-wise, if we're just talking pure touchdowns, I think Kincaid has a higher ceiling there. But Michael Mayer, I think... worst case, now this is going to make me sound like I only compare players to like Hall of Famers. But I think the worst case is like Jason Witten type production for Michael Mayer. I think he's that talented. He's that good a tight end at every aspect of being a tight end. Maybe I don't want to say worst case is Hall of Fame. That's probably putting a little too much on him.
Yeah. Well, I was just about to say, Bomani Jones, very strong opinion, Jason Witten is not a Hall of Famer. Pretty much everybody else seems to think that he is.
I don't think Jason... wherever you put him, like, when I say Jason Witten is the worst-case scenario, I legit mean that as he didn't live up to his potential.
Yeah.
As good as Jason Witten was, as productive as he was, he wasn't special.
Right.
I think high-end for Michael Mayer can be a legit Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Now again,
which is what you want if you're going number 7 in the draft.
Now, the Raiders, they lost Darren Waller, lost LaFortue or whatever, Foster Moreau is his name. I blanked on his name for a second. A lot of people have him for a quarterback, but their team isn't good enough to draft a quarterback and take advantage of that rookie contract. They're going to be picking high again next year. I think you just get a player you know is going to be good at a productive position, and he is someone who, even though your team's not going to be great this year, he will be good and helpful for your team. So Michael Mayer is someone that I'm higher on than basically everyone else. Who's someone else I want to talk about?
While you're looking for that, Darren Waller getting traded to New York. I feel like there ought to be some sort of, I don't know if penalty is the right thing, but like if you trade a spouse to a team where their spouse does not play, so then they got to live on opposite sides of the country. It's a bummer.
It's kind of messed up. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they should have to like give a pick to. The Las Vegas Aces. I don't know how that would work, but...
that'd be fun, like comp money or something like
yeah.
that. So a couple other players I really like. Brian Branch, kind of that nickel safety from Alabama. He didn't test well, so he's going to go a little bit lower. But that's someone else where like you just know you're getting a good starter. I think too many times in the first round, teams try to hit a home run where... I think there's value to, like, this is a good player. We know he's going to play well for us, especially if you're picking back in the first round. Go for it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think Brian Branch, wherever he goes, is going to be a good fit. A couple players outside of the first round. Another tight end I like, Sam Laporta. Now, he was in a terrible offense at Iowa. He's the only legit passing, like, receiving threat. And he still is productive. Not as productive as you'd like to see, but... when a college player is the only obvious threat on their team and they can still produce, that's a great sign. Josh Downs in North Carolina had a similar thing. But I like Sam Laporta a lot. And also, I think the player I mentioned the most was Drew Sanders from Arkansas.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, he's not going to go in the first round, probably not even the second round. But he's someone I put going to the 49ers and would love... Love that. If you just pull up like Drew Sanders highlights, you're gonna see someone who plays all over the field, in the box, on the edge, blitzing from space, in coverage, sideline to sideline, and he's physical. He has some hard hits on his thing. I think he does everything well. He initially played at Alabama as an edge rusher, and you know, converted to linebacker at Arkansas. But you can see his edge rushing and pass rushing abilities come through.
Mm-hmm.
Another player I like, and this will be my last player. I actually don't know how to pronounce his name. It's either Jamie or Jammy Robinson, safety from Florida State. It's J-A-M-M-I-E, so you take that for what it's will. Now, he didn't test well as well. It's kind of like a Brian Branch in the sense that, you know, safety does everything well but didn't test. But Robinson, he's always around the ball. He played in every role, basically. He played in the slot, played as a deep safety, played as coming off the edge a little bit as well. A little bit undersized, which is why I think he'll go in the third round or so, maybe late second. But he's a really good football player, can contribute on special teams. I would love him to go to the Niners as well, and that's where I have him going. But Drew Sanders and Robinson are two players, if your team drafts them, you know, probably in the third round, you know you're getting a really good player who's going to contribute to your team right away.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. Yeah, no, safety is, I feel like, kind of an underappreciated position nowadays, just because cornerback is so focused on. But I love a good, I miss the days with, you know, like Ed Reed and Brian Dawkins and those hard-hitting safety. And obviously the game has changed so much that that's not really a position anymore. Troy Polamalu, that was a fun era in the NFL.
No, being a good safety is fun.
Yeah.
That was my favorite position to play as well, just because there's so much kind of leeway and freedom there. So yeah, so Brian Branch is someone I'm really excited about. So yeah, that's our mock draft article coming out just in time for the draft. That's going to be on mjdoubletake.com. We'll tweet it out on all the social stuff. So a lot of easy ways to see it. I'm really excited about it. Love the NFL draft, so really excited for that to come out. And it ended up being good timing. You ready to get into the top five?
Let's do it.
So this is going to be a bit of a different top five. I was going to do the top five crazy Barry Bonds stats, but there were just so many that I couldn't pick five.
Right.
And And I couldn't even go through the whole list, honestly. I did have to cut some off, but I was going to go through some of my favorite ones. I think there's like eight.
I'm excited.
So, first one, in 2004, he could have, on his hits, he could have gone 373 for the whole season and still had a higher on-base percentage than the top four hit leaders in the National League, because walks don't count as plate appearances.
Right.
So 0-for-373 still would have had a higher on-base percentage.
That's a lot of walks.
Yeah. Speaking of walks, more walks than the Tampa Bay Rays organization in history.
Yes. And currently, in the Tampa Bay Rays, they're still playing.
Still playing. And they're very good. Not walking a lot, though, apparently. So he had five seasons with a 400 on-base percentage in two strike counts. So if you got him to two strikes, he's still 40% likely to get on base somehow.
That doesn't even seem possible.
That doesn't seem fair. I think the average is like under 200, like the batting average, which I know is different than on base percentage. 2001 to 2004, he had more offensive WAR than the Expos, Tigers, Mets, Royals, and Brewers. So more productive offensively than five teams for 3 years. 4 years, I guess. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very good.
In that same 2004 year, he had four more home runs than he had strikeouts, and 24 more home runs than he had singles. So, not only did he hit a home run more than he struck out, which is insane, but he hit a home run more than he just hit a blooper to first base.
Yeah, so he's more likely to hit it out of the park than to get to first base.
Yeah, which is nuts to me.
Yeah, remarkable.
He has a career 986 OPS against pitchers currently in the Hall of Fame.
Very high.
David Ortiz's career batting average, or excuse me, career on base percentage is 380. Barry Bonds, if you turned every 762 home run, all of those into outs, his on base percentage would be 384. So David Ortiz, who is going to get to the Hall of Fame, very good hitter. We saw him live a couple times.
We did.
Barry Bonds, every home run, who's hit more home runs than anybody in the world, turn those all into outs, he's still more likely to get on base than David Ortiz.
Yeah, I wish I had more to say about these, but just kind of, other than they're amazing, there's not much else to say.
Well, we've kind of talked about them off air a lot, so that's why they're pretty unbelievable.
Yeah.
2001 to 2004, he got on base in 94% of his games.
That's a very high percentage.
The distance Barry Bonds walked in his career, now remember, it's 90 feet to first base. He walked 43 miles for his career.
Yeah.
It's 90 feet.
It's like that's more than 50K.
That's insane.
More than a marathon.
If in 2004, if you were a player, you played all 162 games, went 2-for-5 with a home run and a single, 400 batting average, hit 162 home runs, you would have still had a lower OPS than Barry Bonds that year, who had a 1462 OPS.
That, again, just doesn't seem possible.
And literally, none of these seem fake. Now, two more, and then we'll wrap up. So he would have to start playing today and get out a consecutive 1,412 times to drop his career on base percentage to lower than 400. Lower than 400.
Not 300, which is what people talk about a lot.
400,
yeah.
Okay. And last one. He has 13,000 more at-bats over his career than Ken Griffey Jr. and has 85 less outs. So he had 1,300 more opportunities and got out 85 less times than Ken Griffey Jr., who everyone loves. And he's great.
Yeah. 13,000? I didn't even realize players had that many at-bats.
Yeah.
Like, so that seems...
I don't know how many that is over a career, but 1,300 more at-bats than Griffey, 85 less outs. That's unbelievable. Truly the best hitter of all time. I appreciate everyone indulging me on my Barry Bonds stats rant. I believe he should be in the Hall of Fame. I don't believe it's a Hall of Fame without him. Say what you will. I think he's a victim. Happy to chat about it more. Maybe we just have a Barry Bonds episode one day.
I would do a Barry Bonds episode sometime.
I love Barry Bonds. Love the Giants. Appreciate everybody listening. Next week, do you want to... We haven't talked about what we're going to do, record before or after the draft. Probably both. Some sort of fashion. Maybe one last kind of draft tune-up before, then the next week talk, recap the draft probably.
Yeah, I think that sounds good to me.
There's a lot going on, a lot of NBA playoffs as well, so that'll be a focus point next week. Appreciate everybody listening. If you haven't subscribed, feel free to do so wherever you're listening. 5-star review, let us know how you like the pod. The article will be on mjdoubletake.com. We'll talk to y'all next week.